Hello, and welcome to this Microsoft TechNet session on deploying and managing ASP.NET 2.0 applications on IIS 6. The release of the Microsoft ASP.NET version 2.0 has raised the level of administrative complexity that IT pros who manage IIS servers must understand. In this session, we will talk about some of the techniques you can use to deploy and manage both ASP.NET 1.1 and ASP.NET 2.0 applications on the same server. Let's start this session by going into more detail on exactly what we will be covering. Today, we'll talk about what ASP.NET is and how it works with IIS 6.0. ASP.NET is part of the .NET framework. We'll discuss what that means, what the .NET framework provides ASP.NET, and how ASP.NET and IIS work together. This will include a demonstration on how to create a shared assembly and deploy it to the location on your server where all applications can access it. We'll also take an in-depth look at the ASP.NET configuration system and the files that comprise it. Then we'll go into the main issues and tools you should familiarize yourself with so that you can deploy and manage ASP.NET applications, including command line tools and the new ASP.NET 2.0 configuration user interface. This section will include a couple of demonstrations. The first will show how you can automate deploying and managing ASP.NET applications, and the second one will step through how to use the user interface to configure an ASP.NET application to use Forms authentication. Next, we'll briefly talk about the issues you'll encounter when you have multiple versions of ASP.NET and applications that use each installed on your IIS 6.0 server. Finally, we'll touch on the advantages of running ASP.NET applications on 64-bit servers. As with most TechNet sessions, some prior experience of Microsoft technologies or similar technologies is always helpful. Here's a brief overview of what would be helpful, but not essential, for this session. As we go through today's session, you will hear various Microsoft acronyms and terminology. While we will explain all new terms related to today's session, there are some general terms from the industry or from other versions of Microsoft products that we may not spend time on. To help you out, we have listed the areas that it may be helpful to be familiar with, either prior to this session or to reference afterwards. It would be helpful to have some IT administration experience with Microsoft Windows Server 2003, Internet Information Services 6.0, and ASP.NET 1.1. To cover the topics mentioned and keep the session flow going, we have divided the session up into the following agenda items. ASP.NET is part of the .NET framework, so we'll start our presentation by covering some key concepts provided by the .NET framework that you need to know about. This is background information that you can use in your discussions with developers about how best to deploy and manage your ASP.NET applications. Then we're going to look at the ASP.NET configuration system, which is hierarchically distributed across a series of XML-based configuration files. We'll talk about each of these files and how one configuration file inherits settings from those higher up in the hierarchy. We'll get into the meat of the presentation next and discuss techniques, tools, and decision points for deploying and managing your ASP.NET applications. This primarily involves creating and editing the configuration files, but also includes registering a version of ASP.NET with IIS 6.0. We'll talk about automating the deployment and management processes using the ASP.NET reg IIS command line utility, as well as manually performing those tasks with that utility and the ASP.NET MMC snap-in. we'll take an in-depth look at the Snappin user interface and what configuration file changes you can make using it, and touch on tasks that require ASP.NET Reg IIS. Next, we'll talk about the issues you'll encounter when you run applications on your server that use different versions of ASP.NET. ASP.NET and the .NET Framework have been released 3 times since they initially came out in 2001. IIS 6.0 supports all 3 of these releases, so you need to know how each one works separately from the others. Finally, we'll talk about performance improvements offered to ASP.NET 2.0 applications that are built to run on 64-bit platforms. Before we get started with the main presentation, let's run through a quick overview of ASP.NET. So, what exactly is ASP.NET? Well, the first thing you should know is that ASP.NET is part of the .NET Framework. Because of this, developers can access APIs and services that are built into .NET. These include the Global Assembly Cache and Code Access Security, 2 features that we'll talk about in a few minutes. ASP.NET also builds on the power of ASP, giving developers a robust, server-side programming model. ASP.NET 2.0 is the latest version of ASP.NET. You may also be familiar with ASP.NET 1.1 and 1.0. In the course of just a few years, ASP.NET has released 3 different versions. Going back 3 releases of IIS would put us in 1997, so you can see the .NET Framework and ASP.NET teams turn around their products much more quickly than IIS does. That's because they're not tied to the operating system. We'll touch on this at length later. But this means why it's important to know that IIS 6.0 supports multiple versions of ASP.NET. This means that you can run legacy ASP.NET 1.1 and 1.0 applications on the same server with your ASP.NET 2.0 applications. This is known as running ASP.NET side by side, and any problems we run into when running side by side are referred to as versioning problems. It's also important for you to know that ASP.NET runs as managed code, which means that the .NET Framework, not your applications, owns the managed memory. So things like garbage collection are owned by the framework. One of the biggest problems in the past was that developers would put objects into memory and forget to release that memory, causing memory leaks and similar problems. You still need to be aware of issues like that, but ASP.NET running as managed code reduces your chances of making such a mistake. Now we'll take a quick look at our agenda again. Let's talk about some key ASP.NET concepts. They're really concepts that are supported by the .NET Framework, but ASP.NET applications can take advantage of them because they're a part of that framework. We'll begin by taking a look at the Global Assembly Cache. Many IT pros have said that they don't know what the Global Assembly Cache is, so we're going to attempt to demystify it a little bit here. It's nothing more than a predefined registry where .NET assemblies reside to be called by any application. You can also think of the assemblies stored in the Global Assembly Cache as shared assemblies. Most applications also use private assemblies. We'll touch on that later. All of the assemblies that are part of the .NET Framework, like system.dll, system.web.dll, the core ASP.NET assembly, or system.xml.dll, are stored in the Global Assembly Cache once you install the framework. Any .NET application can access them. You can also deploy shared assemblies to the Global Assembly Cache. The key things that you should understand are how to use the global assembly cache, when to deploy an assembly to it, and, most importantly, why would your developers want to use it? The considerations you need to keep in mind before you add assemblies to the global assembly cache are huge. The first one is that any assembly in the global assembly cache is fully trusted by all ASP.NET applications. So any code run from a DLL stored in the global assembly cache has permissions to access the file system on your server, for example. In most situations, you can lock such behavior down, but you can't do that if the code is running from the global assembly cache. You should really have a conversation with your developers about whether an assembly needs to go into the global assembly cache. Not all of them do, and if they don't, then push back against your developers. They could be opening security holes in your application by adding an assembly to the global assembly cache unnecessarily. The second consideration is that all assemblies in the global assembly cache are shared by all ASP.NET applications running on your server. Again, not all assemblies need to be shared across applications, and you really need to make sure that your developers are only exposing assemblies in the global assembly cache that need to be shared across applications. Let's go into more detail on this last point. ASP.NET applications run in the ASP.NET ISAPI extension that is hosted by the IIS worker process W3WP. Suppose we have created two ASP.NET applications, each one running in a separate application domain in the worker process. There's a boundary between the two domains. Each application has a bin directory, and those bin directories are where you deploy any private assemblies for the associated application. Those assemblies can only be used by the associated ASP.NET application. In other words, if you have an assembly that, for a single application, you don't want to share with any other application on the IIS server, you should deploy it into the bin directory. When a request comes in to ASP.NET application 1 for default.aspx, for example, the domain boundary blocks the request from accessing any assemblies that are deployed to the ASP.NET application 2 bin directory, and vice versa. The user code cannot cross that domain boundary. All the application domains running on W3WP are isolated units of processing. The way to get around this application isolation is to deploy an assembly to the global assembly cache. Any assembly that you add to the global assembly cache becomes a shared assembly. These assemblies in the global assembly cache are accessible to application 1, application 2, and any other applications running on the server, regardless of the application boundary. So user code from either of our applications can access the assemblies if you've put the assemblies into the global assembly cache. Either application can take advantage of whatever functionality you've included in the shared assembly. That can be a legitimate business need, depending upon the situation. But as an IT pro, you need to be aware of these differences between global assembly cache and the bin directory. Frequently, your developers may want to put an assembly into the global assembly cache without fully thinking through the implications. Your job is to make sure deploying an assembly to the global assembly cache is absolutely necessary. So with that clear, we're going to look at a demo that shows you how to add an assembly to the global assembly cache, and then see an application that uses that assembly and another that accesses the same functionality from the bin directory. There are a couple of steps to adding an assembly to the global assembly cache, and each requires a different tool. First, you have to generate a strong name for the assembly using the sn.exe utility. After that, you can add your strong named assembly to the global assembly cache using gacutil.exe. We show you how to do this in this demo. Then we're going to demonstrate an application that uses the global assembly cache and one that does not. Let's start by opening the IIS manager to determine how the server is currently configured. We have both ASP.NET 1.1 and ASP.NET 2.0 installed on the computer. It is important for you to know which versions of ASP.NET you have on your server because of versioning issues. We'll discuss this later in the presentation. Now let's look at the files in our demo directory. We've done some automation of the tasks that we're going to perform today, so we created a setup script batch file. Let's open that file and discuss what the script is going to do. It not only sets up the demo, it also lets us know the order of tasks that we're going to perform. The first tool we use is ADSUtil, and with that we're going to create an application pool for the demo. In a little bit, we'll want to make sure that the application pool is only bound to use ASP.NET version 1.1. That's important because each application can only use one version of ASP.NET, and you need to be aware which one your application uses. Our next step is to use iisweb.vbs to stop the default site and create a new site. After that, we assign our new site to the application pool we created earlier. Then we copy the .dll file we want to use to the demo's bin directory. This assembly does not have a strong name, so you can't put it in the global assembly cache. It runs in the private assembly cache for the application, and because we put it in the bin directory, other applications cannot use it. In addition, there is the assembly that's ready to be added to the global assembly cache and the web.config file, which we'll look at in a minute or two so that you have a sense of what the file does. If you're not familiar with web.config or machine.config, we'll be going over them a little later in our presentation. Now we're going back to the command line and talk about actually creating a strongly named assembly and putting it into the global assembly cache. This is really the minimum set of files we need on our system to do this. We have the build assembly command, a create key command, the gacutil.exe utility, and the C# file that we're going to compile, strongname.cs. The first thing we need to do is create a key. So let's open the create key command and look at what it does. The command calls the sn.exe utility, which is part of the .NET Framework SDK. You can use the 2.0 version or the 1.1 version, depending on the ASP.NET version your application uses. Be sure you know which version you need and copy it to the directory in which you create assemblies to add to the global assembly cache. This creates the key for the strong named assembly that we have here. When we invoke the command, it displays the key pair it wrote to the mykey.snk file. If we do a dir command on the directory, it shows us that the key file now exists. Now let's open the command we're going to use to create the assembly so that you can see how this works too. In our .NET framework directory, we have the C# command line compiler. This is what you use to create that strongly named assembly, which is required before you put it in the global assembly cache. As an IT pro, this does not really matter that much to you, but it's good to know what your developers have done to prepare an assembly to add to the global assembly cache. Also, if a problem occurs later and the developer isn't available, or if you're working with a rookie developer, it's good for you to know the process. You could automate all of this, but we want to keep the process simple so that you can understand what we're doing. We point the compiler to the C# file, strongname.cs, and we also define the key. Now we'll run the command, and it does its routine. It takes just a second here, but once it finishes, we'll have a strongly named assembly that we can put into the global assembly cache. Once it's finished, we'll refresh the view on that directory. And there's our new assembly, strongname.dll. Now we only have one more step here, and that is to add the assembly to the global assembly cache. So now we'll use the gatqtil tool, use the minus I command, and specify the strongname.dll assembly. Now this will just take a second, and voila! There we have just added our assembly to the global assembly cache. Let's close the command prompt window. That's all there is to adding an assembly. Hopefully, we've given you some idea of the reasons you would want to do so. Now let's go back to our setup script for a second. We are going to first look at an application that does not use the global assembly cache. Our setup script will copy the assembly that we have strongly named to the bin directory for our sample application. We are also going to copy over a page named page.aspx that we'll use to test this. The page is going to reference this assembly, but it's going to do so from its local assembly cache, the bin directory. Then the script is going to do a little bit of cleanup to prep for some of the later demos in this presentation. This DLL was created using the .NET Framework 1.1, and we're going to use the ASP.NET MMC snap-in to force this application to use version 1.1. Then we're going to test the page. Finally, we'll put the sample.dll file into the global assembly cache using the process we just went through. Now let's return to the command prompt and run this batch file. At each point as the script runs, it will pause so that we can go over what it's doing. First, we created the application pool called ASP.NET 1.1. Let's confirm that in the IIS manager. There is the ASP.NET 1.1 application pool. Our next step is to create the physical directories for the site, stop the default website, and create a new site in IIS called My Site. And we'll check the IIS manager again to verify that the site is there and running. It also contains a bin directory. Now it copies the sample DLL to the bin directory and the page.aspx file to the root directory for my site. Now before we test this, there is one more step. Remember, we have two versions of ASP.NET installed on our server. We need to make sure that our application is using ASP.NET 1.1, and there are a couple of ways to do this. These are key steps. Many developers are keen to use 2.0 since it uses 70% less code. You are going to need to know which version each application uses and how to access the tools for each. We'll open the properties window for the site we created, and then we'll check what version of ASP.NET is running on the site. If we have version 2 selected for our site, that will not work. Our developer wrote the assembly with version 1.1, so we must check that at the very least. When we change the version number in the user interface, IIS changes the script maps for this application so that the correct version of ASP.NET processes the application's incoming requests. If we take a quick look on the Home Directory tab, we'll find that when we check the configuration values for all of the ASP.NET associated extensions, like .aspx, .asmx or .ascx, the directory is for version 1.1.4322. That's how you can double check that your script maps are correct for your application. Let's go ahead and check what happens when we browse to our page in Internet Explorer. This will take just a little bit of time. There is always a delay for the first request to an ASP.NET application because the infrastructure has to be built. This is why you should always make the first request to a deployed application on a production server yourself, so that your users don't see this behavior. Now the content of the ASPX file appears. This page is actually using the module we put in the bin directory to generate this page. What if we wanted other applications to use this functionality? Then we would need to put this assembly in the global assembly cache. As we mentioned earlier, you want to have a conversation with your developers about whether they really need to add the assembly to the global assembly cache. Remember, code always runs from the global assembly cache with full trust, which can compromise the security of your system. Let's say that the developers have convinced you to add the component to the global assembly cache. We have a strongly signed sample DLL all ready to add to the global assembly cache. There's no need to show you how to prep the assembly, so we'll just use gacutil to add it to the cache. We'll also need to copy the web.config file to the mysite directory. So we'll go ahead and copy that, and then do a dir command on the mysite directory. We'll see that the web.config file is there. Now what we're going to do, just to prove to you that the application is getting the assembly from the global assembly cache, is to delete the bin directory. And just to make sure that the previous request wasn't cached, we're going to use the IISApp utility to recycle the application pool. ASP.NET 2.0 makes extensive use of caching, so we just need to make sure that the cache is clean. And before we make the request to get the page, let's go over what is in the web.config file. The file contains the path to the assembly in the global assembly cache that the request will use. We deleted the bin directory, so there's nothing to grab from the local assembly cache. The application will just take a bit to compile again as ASP.NET builds up what it needs to satisfy the request. Once it's done, we can see we have the same button and text box. The request is getting this functionality from the DLL we added to the global assembly cache, even though it looks the same. Now we're going to show you something that might make your developers mad, and that is to uninstall an assembly from the global assembly cache. We use the gacutil tool again and use the uswitch to uninstall. After that's done, we'll recycle the application pool. One assembly has been removed from the global assembly cache. Now, when we browse this page, we find that we get a configuration error. This proves that we were actually running with the DLL we put in the global assembly cache. To set us up for success in the next demo, we're going to do a little cleanup. First, we'll run the script and go to the cleanup section. Finally, we'll use the tool aspnet-regiis to uninstall the version of ASP.NET that we just used, which was 1.1. We'll go into the .NET framework directory and see that we have a v1.1 and a v2.0 directory. We'll start by going to the v1.1 and we'll use the aspnet-regiis tool to uninstall version 1.1. After that's finished, we'll change directories and uninstall version 2.0. We'll use more of the possible commands in our next demo, but for now, we'll let that run and go back to our presentation. Now we'll talk about another key concept you need to be aware of in ASP.NET and the .NET framework. Next, we're going to discuss the ASP.NET configuration files and other basic concepts behind ASP.NET configuration. This is very important to understand because configuration mistakes can cause your deployed applications to break. We'll start off by first discussing the configuration files themselves. The first thing you need to keep in mind is that the IIS and ASP.NET configuration systems are completely separate. IIS is configured through its metabase, while ASP.NET is configured through a series of interrelated XML files. Let's talk then about these configuration files. By default, ASP.NET uses two configuration files. The first is the machine.config file, and it controls the configuration for all of the .NET framework on the server, including ASP.NET. It resides in the ASP.NET root directory on your server, which is dependent upon which versions of ASP.NET are available on your computer. The machine.config file contains the default database connection strings, ASP.NET membership and profile providers, and also defines default section groups and section names. The second configuration file is the web.config file. There can be any number of web.config files on your server, but the first one we'll talk about is the one that controls ASP.NET across the entire computer. This is also stored in the .NET Framework Roots directory. Other web.config files can be used to configure either your website or an application on it. In IIS terms, a web.config file can control configuration for any website or virtual directory on that site. So if you have configuration or deployment requirements for a default website, you'd store them in a web.config file in c:\inetpub/www/root. If you have configuration requirements for a particular application that's represented by a virtual directory in IIS, you'd store them in a web.config file that you put into the physical directory that maps to the application's virtual directory. The configuration settings each file holds are inherited hierarchically. This means that the configuration settings stored in machine.config are inherited by the root web.config file. Unless you specify separate settings in the root web.config file, the settings from the machine.config file will control all ASP.NET settings. By default, this isn't the case, however. The base web.config file, as we said before, specifies several configuration settings that are different from machine.config. Those settings that web.config does not override, it inherits from machine.config. The same is true for site and virtual directory web.config files. Any configuration settings they do not override, they inherit from the web.config file directly above them in the hierarchy. Let's take a look at where these files could be located in a theoretical application directory structure. In this simplified directory structure, we're only showing configuration files and the directories in which they're located. We're also only showing you the ASP.NET 2.0 structure, for simplicity's sake. Knowing the directory in which the configuration file you're working with is located is important with all the deployment and management tools we're going to cover later in our presentation. Our first level of configuration files, the machine.config file and the server-wide web.config file that we discussed earlier, are located in the root directory for the .NET Framework installation. By default, this is c:\Windows/Microsoft.net/Framework/v2.0.50727. These two files, again, are where all other configuration files inherit settings from. The next level of configuration file is located on the website level. So if you want to have a site-wide configuration file, you'd include a web.config file in the root directory for the site. For the default website in IIS, that's c:\inetpub/www/root. If you create a site separate from the default website and want site-wide configuration for it, you would include a web.config file in the physical directory that you assign as the root for that site. You can also set configuration settings for an ASP.NET application that is part of a website. You store these web.config files in the physical application root directory. These directories must be mapped to a virtual directory in IIS. Be clear that configuration setting inheritance does not move laterally. In other words, if you have two ASP.NET applications on a site, they do not inherit configuration settings from each other because they are peers in the configuration system hierarchy. They would both inherit settings from the web.config file stored in the root directory for your website. So how does this work when a request is processed by IIS and the ASP.NET IIS API? Let's discuss the pipeline, the path which a request to an ASP.NET application follows from beginning to end. There are key points in the pipeline that you need to know about so you can understand how the ASP.NET configuration files affect how the request is processed in the pipeline. From the IIS perspective, ASP.NET is simply another request customer. Other customers include Perl, PHP, Static Pages, and Cold Fusion. What you need to know is that ASP.NET is implemented as an IIS API DLL. What that means is that ASP.NET will not receive requests that are not script mapped to it. So if a request comes in for a file with an ASP.NET supported extension, .aspx, .asmx, or any of the others, IIS routes the request to the ASP.NET IIS API DLL. If a request comes in for a file with a .php or an .htm extension, for example, IIS does not invoke the ASP.NET IIS API. Also, if you don't have your script map set up properly, incoming requests will not pass into the appropriate ASP.NET pipeline, and you'll have an application failure. Now let's look at the lifetime of a request. When a request first arrives, IIS performs any authorization and authentication required to let the request come in. There are a number of authentication types, including basic, anonymous, and NTLM. Then IIS determines which script mapped handler it should use to process the request. In the case of an .aspx file, an.asmx, or an.ashx file, it finds the script mapped ASP.NET version and directs the request to the appropriate ASP.NET IIS API. If the ASP.NET application has not run before, ASP.NET creates the app domain and assigns a thread to handle a request processing. It performs any of its own authorization and authentication tasks and maps the incoming file extension to the appropriate handler. This is important because during the ASP.NET processing is when the configuration settings in the machine.config and web.config files kick in. So the authentication type we see here is defined in a web.config file. Any handlers, both default and custom, are defined in the ASP.NET configuration files. So once the request runs through the ASP.NET pipeline, ASP.NET passes the response back to IIS. IIS then sends the response to the requester. Let's again look to our agenda for a moment. Now that you have a good understanding of the global assembly cache, code access security, and how the configuration files work to create the ASP.NET configuration system, let's get to the heart of our presentation today, deploying and managing ASP.NET applications. We'll begin by talking about the different tool-based approaches you can use to deploy and manage your applications. Just to be clear, in the context of our discussion, Deployment includes all configuration tasks required to initially set up an ASP.NET application, while management involves updating configuration settings as needed after you've deployed the application. There are a couple of approaches you can use to get these tasks done. You can perform them manually, or you can choose to automate them. We'll start with the manual approach and the three tools that you can use to perform these tasks manually. The ASP.NET Reg IIS utility allows you to set up the application's environment with the correct version of ASP.NET and allows you to configure the application. You can install and uninstall the ASP.NET version associated with this tool and register the version of ASP.NET with IIS 6.0. You can also perform configuration tasks using the ASP.NET MMC snap-in provided through IIS Manager. This snap-in is a user interface that has different tabs for different configuration elements and really simplifies application configuration. The ASP.NET team designed this to capture most of the common configuration scenarios that IT pros or developers may change on a regular basis. Finally, you can use the website administration tool that ships with Visual Web Developer. This tool offers a simpler user interface for configuring your application, but for the detailed needs of an enterprise environment, it isn't the best choice. We'll talk more about each of these tools later in our presentation. Now let's move on to our second approach for deployment and management. There are a couple of ways to automate deployment and management of your ASP.NET applications. The first is to write manage code to access the system.configuration namespace APIs to change the settings in the machine.config or web.config files. Just to add an IIS perspective, this is similar to using WMI to make, set, or modify metabase settings. The second method is to create a batch file that calls the ASP.NET Reg IIS utility. By doing this, you can make sure that your environment is set up properly and that all of your configuration settings are correct for your application. Many Microsoft sites use this utility in combination with other tools shipped with IIS 6.0 to script and automate their environments. So when you deploy an application, you'll create your website or application tool and then use ASP.NET Reg IIS to set the appropriate script maps and versions so that you know exactly what ASP.NET platform your application is going to use. We'll discuss why this is so important when we talk about versioning. Now let's go into more depth on the ASP.NET Reg IIS utility. Remember that you can use the ASP.NET Reg IIS utility either manually or in an automated environment. If you use the utility manually, you should know that the MMC snap-in is safer. Since ASP.NET configuration is dependent on the physical configuration files, if you add bad content to them, your application won't run. The snap-in is safer because it won't add bad configuration settings to the machine.config or web.config files, while it is possible to do so using ASP.NET Reg IIS. That being said, there are some configuration settings that you can only modify from the command line. For example, the ASP.NET Reg IIS utility allows you to install and uninstall ASP.NET, register the ASP.NET version with IIS 6.0, and create and delete the script maps required by IIS to send requests to the correct version of ASP.NET. In addition, the MMC snap-in doesn't support automation. You need to use ASP.NET Reg IIS if you want to automate deployment and management. This is particularly helpful for performing tasks that you need to perform repeatedly, like updating your website and modifying configuration, or, if you're a website host, setting up ASP.NET websites. Now you can use the ASP.NET Reg IIS in combination with some of the IIS 6.0 utilities to set up your environment. For example, you could use the adsutil.vbs to create an IIS application pool, then use iisweb.vbs to create a website in the app pool, and use ASP.NET Reg IIS to install or enable ASP.NET 2.0 and change the IIS script map to 2.0. Another detail you should be aware of is that for each version of ASP.NET you've installed on your server, there's a unique version of the ASP.NET Reg IIS utility. So if you had a server with ASP.NET 1.1 and ASP.NET 2.0 installed, there would be two versions of the utility on the server. Make sure you know which version of the utility you're using and that it matches with the ASP.NET version that you want to configure. This is a versioning issue, a topic we'll discuss near the end of the presentation today. Let's take a quick tour of some of the more commonly used ASP.NET Reg IIS command switches. Enable and disable are pretty straightforward actions. But when we get into the switches that update the IIS script maps, that is when we need to be careful and know exactly what each switch does. The minus I switch installs ASP.NET and updates all IIS script maps from the previous versions of ASP.NET. You should be particularly careful when you use the minus R or minus S switch, because each of them updates script maps recursively. So when you run ASP.NET Reg IIS using minus R or minus S, they'll both update all existing script maps on your server to the version of ASP.NET that the utility is associated with. For example, if you run ASP.NET Reg IIS for ASP.NET 1.1 and use the minus R switch, all 1.1 and 2.0 script maps in IIS will be changed to 1.1, period. The same is true if you use the minus S command to install a version of ASP.NET. So when you use those switches, proceed with caution. No one remembers the usage of these switches, so be sure to double check the help file for ASP.NET Reg IIS before you use any of them to make sure that the command does what you want. What you should take away from this is that some of the utility switches do perform recursive updates. Now let's take a look at our demo that shows how to automate the use of the ASP.NET Reg IIS tool. We'll use a batch file to show how you can call ASP.NET Reg IIS to automate deployment and configuration tasks. If we check the web service extensions in IIS Manager, there are no versions of ASP.NET there. We just need to force a refresh on our application pool and the website views, so we close IIS Manager. When we reopen it, there are no traces of our last demo anymore. We want to show you the batch file we're using to set up our two versions of ASP.NET. First, the batch file is going to install version 1.1 and register it only. It's also going to install 2.0 and set it as the default version for all applications to use. That means we're going to put that at the global level of W3SVC, so any new applications are going to inherit 2.0 as the version they will run on. The batch file creates an application pool to be used by ASP.NET 1.1. This means that even though the server is configured to run ASP.NET 2.0 by default, we can still use it to run our legacy 1.1 applications on the same server. Then the script creates a directory for our site and creates the site itself in the application pool that we created. Then it's going to configure that website to use ASP.NET 1.1. There are two commands. The first is the minus K command, so that the minus S will work. The minus S command is the recursive command that sets everything for our new site to run on ASP.NET 1.1. You may be asking yourself why this is so complicated. That's because in IIS 6.0, the versions of ASP.NET are divided into two completely separate stores. It's also complicated because of the way ASP.NET uses its configuration files. There's a machine.config and a rootweb.config for each version. Let's go ahead and start our script. It will take some time here to work its way through because we are installing the whole of ASP.NET 1.1. This is just 1.1, remember. Now let's look in the IIS Manager to check our progress. In Web Service Extensions, ASP.NET version 1.1 appears, but IIS has marked it as prohibited. If we wanted to allow it, we would use ASP.NET Reg IIS minus IR, but we don't want version 1.1 to be the default, so we save that command for our install of version 2.0. Now we install ASP.NET 2.0. We use this script to demonstrate an automated way to install versions of ASP.NET. Do you have to do it this way? No, you can do this manually. But by using automation in your batch files or scripts, you can use WMI to change the settings in the IIS metabase, or you can connect to different servers that you have in a web farm. These are the kinds of utilities and automation techniques used by sites like Microsoft.com because they have a number of version 2.0 sites and 1.1 sites. If we go back to the Web Service Extensions list and refresh it, ASP.NET version 2.0 now appears and is allowed and enabled. But it's still installing. This version is significantly bigger than the first, so it takes more time. If you'll remember, we said our next step was to create an application pool that's going to use version 1.1. We go ahead and press Enter to have the script do that. And we're successful. We now have an app pool for our site, and it is named ASP.NET 1.1. We press Enter again to create the directory for our site. Our next command was to create the website in IIS, and if we press Enter again, the script will go ahead and do that. It's done, and associated the site with our application pool we created. Also, we've instructed IIS not to start the site yet. We also have stopped the default website here, so that once our new site is started, we won't get headers from the default website. And then we press Enter again, and here is our site. The utility gives us the site status, which is started. Now, one more time, we press Enter, and this will configure our application to use 1.1 rather than 2.0. We use the minus K switch with the 2.0 version of ASP.NET Reg IIS so that its script maps are removed from our new site. Then we change directories to use the 1.1 version of the tool and use the minus S switch with W3SVC and the number of the site. When you create a site, IIS automatically generates a number for the site. You can go in and get this number, which is how we knew what our site number would be. There's nothing really fancy here. Notice that it's doing this using version 1.1.4322, and it's doing it recursively. We have just accomplished setting up our site. If you wanted to, you could use this type of script to copy content over to a production server, but this is the basic way to automate deployment and management using ASP.NET Reg IIS. If we return to IIS Manager and look at application pools, we'll see that we have the ASP.NET 1.1 application pool in there. We right-click our site and click Properties, then go to the home directory and find that my site is using our new application pool, ASP.NET 1.1. What's key here is that you understand the capabilities of the ASP.NET Reg IIS tool. Don't worry about remembering switches. Simply know how to use the help for the tool and you'll be fine. Know what the tool can do, that it installs and uninstalls ASP.NET, and that it will change script maps in the IIS metabase. Another key is that you know where the boundary is between IIS configuration and ASP.NET configuration. Now we'll go into more detail on the ASP.NET MMC snap-in. As we discussed earlier, ASP.NET 2.0's configuration system is hierarchical and distributed. Each of the files in the system is quite complex on its own, so the snap-in was created to mask that complexity and make manual configuration easier. The ASP.NET MMC snap-in is available from the IIS properties window. When you open that property window, you will find the tab for it. You'll want to keep track of the level in the IIS manager on which you've opened the property window, because the configuration file that you edit or create depends on the location in that hierarchy. For example, if you open the window from the default website in IIS, you'll edit the web.config file for the entire default site. The same is true for a virtual directory. We touched on this earlier, but it bears repeating. The MMC doesn't allow you to enter invalid configuration values or place a key value in the wrong location. This keeps application failures caused by such human errors from happening. So once you open the properties window and click the ASP.NET tab, you'll see the main user interface. There are a few things you should know about it. In the drop-down list, you'll see the ASP.NET version number for which the snap-in is registered. You will see either 2.0.50727 or 1.1.4322, depending on which version you have installed in your server. If you have both versions installed, you will be able to switch the user interface from working with one version to working with another if you need to. You'll also see the virtual path and location of the file. Remember those different configuration files, the machine.config and all the possible web.config files? The file location box will tell you which of those files you're editing. The file location is a good tool for you to use to make sure you're working on the correct configuration file. The user interface also displays the creation date and time, along with the date and time at which you last modified the file, which can help you track your change history. So let's drill into the other MMC user interface pages. When you click the Edit Configuration button, you'll see a window that displays all of the possible configuration setting types that you can edit, each one contained on a tab. Once you get to this screen, you need to know where you want to go to edit the configuration settings you want. This presentation should give you a sense for that. The first tab is the General tab. It allows you to perform resource level configuration, such as database connection strings and application settings, so it's pretty straightforward. Our second tab is the one that lets you define custom errors. Now you may not have known that IIS and ASP.NET use separate custom errors. Depending on the code path for a particular request, you may get IIS custom errors or ASP.NET custom errors. Remember we talked about the pipeline earlier, and if you never hit the ASP.NET DLLs, you're going to hit the IIS custom errors. For example, if you're trying to access a static resource, like an image, and you get an access denied error, you'll get an IIS custom error. While if you get an error while accessing something in ASP.NET, you'll get one of those custom errors. This tab is where you configure those errors. Next, we have the Authorization tab and the Authentication tab. We're going to be talking about these a lot in just a few minutes because they're both involved in our next demo, how to enable forms authentication and URL authorization to deny users access. The Application tab lets you set connection strings and App Settings configuration sections. The State Management tab lets you edit the Session State section settings, and the last one, the Locations tab, allows you to define settings that the user interface will enter into the configuration file as location tags. Let's take a closer look at each of these tabs. The Configuration tab has a couple of sections that you can edit or add to. The first is the Connection Strings Manager, which allows you to edit, add, and remove database connection strings to the configuration file. The second section is the Application Settings sections. Here you can add name-value pairs to store for the entire application. Developers can then access these values from anywhere in the application and only have to edit them in one spot, the configuration file in which they're stored. Now let's look at the Custom Errors tab. You can use the Custom Errors tab to configure how ASP.NET responds when a processing error occurs. It's got a few things of interest here for us. The first box is where you can set whether custom errors are displayed at all, or whether they're displayed only when a remote computer makes a request for an ASP.NET page in your application. The default redirect URL box just below allows you to define a default error page that ASP.NET will display when an unhandled error occurs. The inherited custom errors section displays all the errors that you defined in web.config files higher in the configuration hierarchy. So if you define some custom errors for your entire site, when you open the MMC snap-in for a virtual directory that's on that site, you'd see the errors for that site in this box. Finally, we have the local custom errors box, which displays the custom errors associated with the current site or virtual directory. Now let's take a look at the authorization tab. The Authorization tab is simple. Its first box lists the authorization settings, including types, verbs, roles, and users, that the current configuration file has inherited from the files higher up in the configuration hierarchy. The second box lists the authorization settings that have been defined in the current configuration file. This is where you can add new authorization rules for a site or a virtual directory. We'll see more about this tab in a few minutes when we demonstrate the MMC snap-in. As you probably know, authorization and authentication go hand in hand. So let's move to the Authentication tab. The Authentication tab works with the Authorization tab to help you configure who and how you let users access your ASP.NET site or application. The first area is authentication settings. This is where you set the authentication mode to Windows, Passport, Forms, or none. If you choose Forms authentication, the second section provides you with the inputs to configure the HTTP cookie, the URL of the page where the user will sign into your site, and indicate whether the application uses Secure Sockets layer to protect the login information while it's transported across the wire. The last two sections allow you to configure and manage membership and role providers. Again, we'll look a little more at this tab in just a few minutes in our demo. But first, let's go on to the Application tab. The Application tab allows you to configure settings that are applied across your application. Generally speaking, this tab will be used by developers more than IT pros, but it's good for you to know some of the options that they consider so that you can know more about their process of constructing an application. The first section lets you define the default programming language for every page in the application, like C# or Visual Basic. It also lets you define the path to a default theme and to a default master page, enabling debugging and set an execution timeout for incoming requests. In the second section, you can set globalization configurations, including request and response encoding and culture codes. And in the third section, you can configure identity settings for when you have defined that the application uses impersonation. If you choose to use impersonation, there are fields to enter the username and password that the application should use. So now let's move on to our next tab. The State Management tab allows you to configure how the session state for the application is stored. It lets you manage state and page information over multiple requests for the pages in the current website. ASP.NET Session State lets you store and retrieve values for a user account as the user navigates the different ASP.NET pages that make up a web application. The State Management tab lets you configure how and where the values are stored. The Session State Settings section allows you to configure the session state mode. The default mode is in PROC, which means the session state is stored in the same process in which the application is running. You can also choose whether you want to use cookies to help store session state information. Other session state mode options include State Server and SQL Server. If you choose either of these, you have to perform further configuration tasks in the user interface. If you choose Session Server, you are configuring ASP.NET to store session state in a process separate from the ASP.NET application. You must define a connection string to this process and can also set a timeout so that if the ASP.NET application cannot connect to the session state process, its thread will not remain open and cause the application to stall. If you choose SQL Server, you are configuring ASP.NET to store session state in a SQL Server database. You must define the connection string to that database. Keep in mind that ASP.NET session state settings are complex, and frequently you'll have to perform other configuration tasks on the configuration files, either using aspnetregis.axe or by directly editing the configuration file. Now we'll look at the Locations configuration tab, the last of the ASP.NET configuration tabs. The Locations tab is a simple user interface. The tab allows you to add and manage location configurations, which are path location configurations that are defined in configuration files for nodes. You can use location tags to apply configuration settings to a specific web application, directory, or file using the path attribute. You can use the Locations tab of the ASP.NET Configuration Settings dialog box to embed configuration settings inside a configuration file. Let's touch on a couple of points about the ASP.NET snap-ins behavior before we move on to our demonstration. This is a bit of a reiteration of some points we've scattered through our discussion of the snap-in, but it's good to present them again so that you'll better remember them. So let's start by going over again the ASP.NET team's reasons for creating this user interface for configuring your applications. The first is that a lot of inadvertent errors can occur when people edit directly in the machine.config and web.config files. The schema for the configuration files is very strict, and any small typo can cause an application failure. Remember, these config files are case sensitive, so if you put a capital letter in the wrong place or forget to camel case a tag, you're going to cause a failure. The MMC user interface cannot read configuration files that contain malformed XML. When you input an error through the MMC's user interface, it won't accept the error and will inform you that you need to re-enter the information. Finally, after you've deployed an ASP.NET application, you should only edit configuration files when you have to. The reason is that changing the application in any way causes ASP.NET to reload the application domain, and you'll lose any caching in process session state that was associated with the running application. A good way to approach edits, if you can, is to group your edits to configuration files so that as many changes are pushed through in one update as possible. You should perform all tests on a test server and then upload the final changes to your production server. Now we'll go ahead and step through our demonstration. In this demo, we'll configure an application with the ASP.NET MMC snap-in to enable it to perform forms authentication. Again, we have a setup script for our demo, and we're not going to go into detail with this one because it does the same things we've seen in earlier demos. But we'll talk through what it does as it works away. The batch file will pause at the locations we specified. It has created the directory. Now it copies the .aspx files to the directory. The script stops the default website, creates a new website, and adds it to the default application pool. Then it starts the new site. Finally, we install ASP.NET and register it. This takes a little bit, so we're going to have to wait just for a moment or two here. You need to run through this setup process for any ASP.NET site or application. It is not specific to forms authentication. Now that the script has run, let's go into the IIS manager and make sure everything is working properly. The site is there and running, and the default website is stopped. Before we do any configuration, let's just browse to the default page. It takes just a second for ASP.NET to run through the first time request, and then the content appears with a bold header, a hello, and a sign out button. So let's open the properties sheet for our site, and then go to the ASP.NET tab. We'll see that version 2.0 is in use here. Everything looks good so far, so we'll edit the configuration for our application now. We can start setting up forms authentication now. We'll start by going into authorization and adding a deny rule. Then we'll click anonymous users and then click OK. Now what we've done for our site here is to tell it that it does not accept incoming requests from anonymous users. From now on, it will only allow users to access the site who supply their username and password. Now that we have the authorization part configured, let's move on to the authentication section. We can change the authentication mode from Windows to Forms. We also want to define the path to the logon page. In this case, we're using the default, so we won't change it. Then we go ahead and click OK. We will ignore membership and roles for now. There are other demonstrations that go into more detail on how to use this ASP.NET 2.0 functionality. So if you want to learn more, links to presentations on that will be included later. So what happens when we refresh the page we just opened? Remember, the configuration has been stored to the file and now it is being picked up. So instead of getting default.aspx, we are redirected to the new logon form asking for a username and password. After we enter the email address and password and click logon, we're authenticated and back to the default.aspx page. This page grabs the username we entered and displays it as text. Using the ASP.NET configuration user interface makes this task a lot easier. In previous versions of ASP.NET, you'd have to write XML into the web.config file for your site, and you'd need to make sure you didn't introduce any mistakes into the configuration file. But we were able to do all of this without looking at any XML. The other nice thing about ASP.NET configuration is that once you perform these steps, you can simply xcopy the web.config files to other IIS servers to deploy the configuration changes. Now let's return to our agenda and the discussion of ASP.NET versioning. We've mentioned ASP.NET versioning issues throughout our presentation. Now we're going to look at them in depth on their own. So let's move straight into why you need to be aware of these issues. So what do we mean when we say versioning exactly? In this case, it means that IIS 6.0 supports running different versions of ASP.NET simultaneously. As we mentioned earlier, this presents some challenges when you set up your deployment environment. So let's quickly go over the things you need to know about IIS versioning support. First, you can only run one version of ASP.NET at a time in an IIS 6.0 application pool. You also need to make sure that you use the appropriate version of the ASP.NET Reg IIS tool. Each install of ASP.NET has its own version of this utility, and to call them, you need to know the location of the version you want to use. Also, IIS scriptmap behavior is different when you install ASP.NET 2.0 on a server if you have ASP.NET 1.1 already on it than it is if there is no pre-existing version of ASP.NET. If ASP.NET 1.1 isn't installed, IIS scriptmaps automatically send ASP.NET requests to version 2.0 after you've installed it. You also only have one ASP.NET regiis.exe utility, and it's in the Roots 2.0 directory. If ASP.NET 1.1 is already installed, when you install ASP.NET 2.0, IIS will default to the 1.1 scriptmaps, and no existing scriptmaps will be updated. So you'll need to use the 2.0 ASP.NET Reg IIS utility to prepare your environment to deploy any ASP.NET applications. There are two versions of the utility as well, so it's really important to keep those directory locations straight for each one. We'll return to our agenda one more time. Our last topic is about ASP.NET and 64-bit Windows platforms. The 64-bit Windows Server platform offers you a lot when you're running web applications. IIS 6.0 and ASP.NET 2.0 can both run natively on the Windows 64-bit server platform. This is the first version of ASP.NET that supports 64-bit. You can run ASP.NET 1.1 applications on IIS 6.0 on Windows Server 2003 Service Pack 1 by using the Windows 32 on Windows 64 compatibility layer. However, IIS 6.0 only supports 32-bit worker processes in worker process isolation mode on 64-bit Windows. You cannot mix 32-bit and 64-bit worker processes on the same servers. Running your ASP.NET 1.1 applications in WOW mode can increase your virtual memory from 2GB to 4GB. You have to run the iisadsutil.vbs script utility from the w3svc/atpools directory to enable this emulation. When you run ASP.NET 2.0 applications natively on the Windows 64-bit platform, you have practically unlimited virtual memory, so that common problem of running low on virtual memory and performance suffering because of it should go away. And, obviously, your application performance should be greatly enhanced by migrating to 64-bit. There's one caveat though. The ASP.NET MMC snap-in will not work on the 64-bit platform. In this session, we talked about two important features of the .NET framework, the global assembly cache and code access security, and saw a demonstration of how to add assemblies to the global assembly cache. we discussed the ASP.NET configuration system and how it is distributed over a number of XML-based files. We also learned how the configuration settings are inherited hierarchically from one configuration file to those lower in the hierarchy. We also covered demonstrations on a couple of tools you can use to deploy and manage your ASP.NET applications, including the command line ASP.NET Reg.IS utility and the ASP.NET MMC snap-in. Finally, we talked about running multiple versions of ASP.NET on your server and some of the benefits of running ASP.NET on a Windows 64-bit platform. To get more information on the products and technologies we have covered today, we have some online resources available that can help. For the most comprehensive technical information on Microsoft products, visit the TechNet website at www.microsoft.com/technet. You can also visit www.microsoft.com/technet/add-20 for more information on books, courses, certifications, and other community resources that relate directly to this particular session. There are a number of other resources that are available from Microsoft. There are a couple of good books from Microsoft Press that might help you. The first is the Microsoft IIS 6.0 Administrator's Pocket Consultant. And the second is the Microsoft Internet Information Services 6.0 Resource Kit. Microsoft also has instructor-led courses if you prefer the classroom-style environment. Microsoft Learning develops courseware called Microsoft Official Curriculum, which includes e-learning, Microsoft Press Books, workshops, clinics, and Microsoft Skills Assessment. MOC is offered in instructor-led environments. It offers comprehensive training courses for IT professionals in supporting and implementing solutions using Microsoft products and technologies. The course that best supports this section is Upgrading Web Development Skills from ASP to Microsoft ASP.NET, which is available as an online course now. This course dedicates an entire section to ASP.NET application deployment. For more information, please visit www.microsoft.com/learning. There is also an assessment program available that can help you test your knowledge. Microsoft Skills Assessment is a free online learning tool. It's an easy way for IT professionals to check their skills. You can quickly check your skills in implementing or managing Microsoft products or business solutions. Just take a short 30-question assessment and see how well you know your stuff. The skills assessment includes a personalized learning plan, which includes links to Microsoft Official Curriculum, specific TechNet articles, Microsoft Press Books, and other Microsoft Learning content. There's also a way to measure how well you did compared with others who took the same assessment. Microsoft Skills Assessment is an expanding learning platform. Available now are assessments for Windows Server 2003, including Security and Patch Management, Exchange Server 2003, Windows Storage Server, Office 2003, and VisualStudio.net. If you want to take your skills assessment to the next level, a number of certification programs are available. In the highly competitive IT job market, how can you set yourself apart from the next candidate? The Microsoft certification program provides that edge. Earning a specific accreditation provides objective validation of the ability to successfully perform critical IT functions. Embraced by industry professionals worldwide, Microsoft certification remains one of the most effective ways to reach long-term career goals and is a surefire way for companies to develop and retain valuable IT staff. Several accreditations are available, starting with the basic Microsoft Certified Professional. You can become a fully certified system administrator, system engineer, or a desktop specialist. Away from the infrastructure side, the MCDBA certification covers the SQL Server products. For more information about the certification program, visit www.microsoft.com/learning/MCP. This session was brought to you by TechNet. TechNet has gone through some changes recently, which you might find interesting. To help explain this in more detail, here's Ian Brackenbury, TechNet Subscriptions Product Manager.
TechNet Plus Subscription introduces its newest offering, TechNet Plus Direct. With TechNet Plus Direct, subscribers get all of the benefits of TechNet Plus for 30% less. Subscribers receive fast, easy access to the tools and information they need to get the most out of Microsoft solutions. A subscription provides IT professionals with immediate online access to all the essential technical resources they need to resolve technical issues faster, get hands-on experience with the latest Microsoft technologies, and build technical skills. Subscribers now get immediate access to all their subscription features in one convenient location, our new online benefits portal. Subscribers get access through subscriber download to Microsoft full version software for evaluation and beta releases without time or feature limits. No more waiting for media shipments. This includes Microsoft Server, client, and application software titles. With full version software, subscribers can make informed decisions about new technologies and deployments at their own pace. For the toughest technical questions, a TechNet Plus subscription also comes with two complimentary professional support incidents. Subscribers can talk to a Microsoft support professional to quickly resolve their mission-critical technical issues fast. TechNet Plus also provides access to over 100 managed news groups. Subscribers can exchange ideas with other professionals and get expert answers to their technical questions within the next business day, guaranteed. In addition, subscribers can also chat with a Microsoft Search Assistant online for help finding the technical resources they need or for assistance with non-technical questions. Subscribers also get access to technical information and tools, including the TechNet Plus library containing the knowledge base, security updates, service packs, resource kits, and more. TechNet Plus offers proven value that far exceeds its cost. The two complimentary professional support incidents alone more than offset the cost of a TechNet Plus subscription. Add to that the evaluation and beta software and other technical resources, and TechNet Plus clearly boosts productivity. Every IT professional on the team needs one. TechNet Plus is available exclusively online without media shipments. For more information, please visit technet.microsoft.com/subscriptions. There are a number of free community resources available on TechNet. You can attend a regular chat with members of the product groups or technology specialists from Microsoft, or you can attend a webcast where you can see sessions like the one you've just watched, but presented live and with the ability to ask questions as you go. You can also read or post questions in public news groups. The newsgroup page lists the available groups and provides an interface from which you can read and post messages. TechNet Plus subscribers can use these groups to post questions, and through their subscription ID, are guaranteed a response from Microsoft support professionals and IT experts by the next business day. The main community site provides a comprehensive list of resources available, more than we can cover on this slide, and the page has some dynamic features with continually updated content. The events page provides dates and details about attending a live TechNet event. These events take place around the world and provide the opportunity for you to talk to Microsoft specialists face-to-face. And finally, the TechNet columns provide a variety of topics written by industry authors. And with that, thank you for taking the time to listen to this TechNet session.